Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Wollersheim Winery, Distillery, and Bistro, where Wisconsin wine and spirits are all made on-site, open year-round. More information and store hours are available at wollersheim.com.
Support for WPR comes from Ephraim Door County, with evenings in Ephraim Bone Day Market. An outdoor market, Mondays from June 16th to August 25th, from 3:30 to 6:30. Ephraim-DoorCounty.com.
Stand alone, my soul is jealous. It wants love, but I reject it. Trade my joy for my protection. Grab my hand, I'm drowning. I feel my heart pounding. Why haven't you found me yet? I hold you so proudly. Traumas, they surround me. I wish you just loved me back.
That's the song Trauma. What happens to children experiencing homelessness, abuse, abandonment, and other crises when they go to school? And how can parents, teachers, and counselors work together to provide them with the support they need? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest is Travis Wright, Faculty Director of UW's Morgridge Center for Public Service, Professor of Counseling, Psychology, and Education, and the author of Emotionally Responsive Teaching, Expanding Trauma-Informed Practice with Young Children. Welcome to University of the Air.
Hi, Emily. Good morning.
Good morning. Actually, could we do that again? Because it'll air.
Don't say good morning. Okay, yeah.
Okay. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks, Emily. I'm super excited to be here.
You know, I really enjoyed reading the book because when I set out, I thought it was going to be filled with educational jargon and kind of this academic book. But I like the way you weave together your own background when you were a child, your role as a father, your role as a counselor, your role as a former teacher, including teaching in Washington, D.C. You know, it's almost like a mixture of memoir with practical advice, with academically grounded research. But different kind of book than I'm used to reading. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll accept that as a great compliment.
Yeah, a readable academic book. That's a feat. Can you tell me a little bit about your own story as to why you came to write this book?
Yep. Well, that's sort of actually it speaks to what you just observed about the way the book is written. I believe that we all teach our own stories. And I think that stories are really what change us the most. And ultimately, I think the book is about allowing children to create stories of their own that help them feel stronger and more powerful in the world. And so so this book is very much an effort to pull together my experiences as a teacher, as a parent, as a child who experienced certain traumas when he was younger, and my academic career. So the book is really trying to ask that question, how do we help children with challenging lives be successful in school? My first job out of college was teaching sixth grade in Washington, D.C. public schools. And from my classroom, you could see the dome of the Capitol building. And almost none of my children had ever visited the Capitol grounds. In fact, in the class of 23 students, only about three of them could actually read beyond the fourth grade level. And it just seemed so wrong to me.
Mm-hmm. And I think you mentioned that it was that there were no white students in the class either, that it was a very racially segregated in a certain way class, and that the pressures on you as a teacher made you feel like you were pushed to do things that you shouldn't be doing as a teacher. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, something that isn't in the book, my students actually called me their light teacher because they could not believe that a white person could be so engaged in their lives, which I think really speaks to how profound kind of the racial divide is for many people in this country. I felt tremendous pressure from the system to help these children sort of catch up, to meet targets, to sort of move from below basic to basic. And it was really sort of at the children instead of with the children. We were actually given egg timers, and the lessons were so scripted that for each unit of the lesson, we were given a certain amount of time, and there were coaches that would walk through the hallways. And if your egg timer sort of rang out of sequence, then the coach would run into your room and ask what was happening. And so it just, you know, I watched children struggle. When children were struggling, there wasn't time to stop. Children would feel stressed. Children were having hard times. And as teachers, we weren't really allowed to tend to those things. We sort of had to impose a curriculum on them as opposed to really meeting the children where they were. And it felt wrong to me. At that point in my teaching life, I didn't know how to fix it, but I knew that this wasn't the answer. And that's really what drove me back to grad school.
I think you also mentioned that you were told by administrators to just focus on 3 students because you weren't going to keep your job or get the right scores or the school wouldn't score right unless you could advance 3 students out of the class. So you just sort of are to pick those and ignore the rest a bit. That seems like it would make you rather cynical as a teacher if you're being told just ignore, you know, most of your students and focus on the measurements that will help us, you know, advance as a school.
Absolutely. You know, it felt like an impossible and a heart-wrenching task, a little bit like Sophie's choice. I think as education has become sort of more corporatized and we really use sort of averages and data to kind of track success, I think that we've really lost sort of just how fundamentally important it is for education to be about the person or a person in front of us. You know, to your point, in the classroom that I was teaching in, we were told that we were going to keep our funding, that the school was going to stay open if we could meet certain benchmarks. And so what that translated to is that each teacher had to move one child each level. And the principal simply said, pick the 3 that are closest and focus on them, and the rest will just have to sort of be contained. And, you know, it was heartbreaking. There's still a stop sign in Washington, D.C. that, you know, for that year that I taught in the school, every morning as I approached the stop line, when I stopped at that stop sign, I would sort of open the door and throw up. I was so nervous about going to school. And last year I was in D.C. and I drove through my old neighborhood. When I approached that stop sign, I felt nauseous again. And I was the teacher. I had sort of, in theory, so much power in that classroom, and I felt terrified and nauseous. And I can only imagine how the children must have felt.
And part of that seems to be, I mean, running through the book, I don't know whether you intended it or not, you know, the last chapter where it's the courage to care. But running through it is the fact that you care deeply about the children wherever you were placed, and that concern, that compassion, that care can really make it hard when you're not able to fix problems that are so deep. If you have a child that's in your classroom who's coming out of a situation of abuse and hunger and homelessness, and then they're acting out in your classroom, that's just a sort of untenable situation that it places you in. One thing that struck me about the approach you have in your book is that you talked about when you were a teacher, you would sometimes resent the counselors because they got the one-on-one time and they were trying to tell you what you should do with one child when you were trying to run a whole classroom. But then when you were a counselor working with children and you saw how sometimes teachers in the classroom were missing the backstory, missing the underlying needs of that child. So you've kind of been on both sides. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. You know, I think in schools that struggle or when working with children or classrooms that are struggling, so often there isn't enough oxygen that everyone is competing to have their needs met. And when school systems become policed, and when schools become policed and classrooms and teachers become policed, I think everyone feels sort of afraid, right, of being viewed negatively by a colleague. And I think that is often where sort of teachers and counselors on the front line find themselves. You know, teachers feel vulnerable and they know that this child that they're struggling with who is struggling is going to the therapy room. The child may be telling things about the counselor. Many counselors, you know, don't feel like it's ethical to share information with the teachers. And so there's a chasm there of mistrust that develops. Sometimes I think counselors aren't really aware of the demands of the classroom and sort of what teachers are being asked to do. And so in a well-intentioned but sort of misguided way, they sort of give the teacher a list of strategies that just feel completely out of touch with her reality. And at the same time, I think I certainly experienced this as a teacher, and I've talked with many teachers who felt the same way. They just feel jealous, right? That, you know, they sort of walk into their classrooms and they see their children sort of fearful or frustrated or angry or acting out. And then the counselor walks in and the child looks like they're going to get a reprieve and they can't wait to see the counselor. And, you know, maybe the counselor hugs children and the teacher doesn't. And I think there is just some heartbreak there. There's just some good old fashioned just feeling rejected or wishing that one could have the same type of connection. And I think part of this book is meant to align those intentions. You know, I really believe that, you know, teachers and counselors show up every day because they want to care about children. They do care about children. They often have different jobs, and they don't necessarily understand each other's job. You know, I now teach in a counseling program. We don't teach any classes on teaching, right? Like teachers, you know, our counselors are not trained to sort of understand what school is like for children. And as teachers, we had sort of a small unit on child development, but there really wasn't a lot on sort of kids' emotional lives. And so I think sort of these two important people in the child's life sort of each lack the perspective of the other. And part of the book is one of the goals of the book is to figure out how to bring these two important perspectives in conversation with each other so that the children can feel more integrated, the support can feel more integrated. And at the end of the day, the kids are more seen and valued and respected.
And then there's the parents or whatever home life they have as well as that
yes.
other part where so much can be happening that is having an impact in the classroom as well.
Yep.
Well, let's look at the term trauma. You spend quite a bit of time in the book sort of looking at different definitions because we can use a term like trauma fairly lightly without kind of deciding what it means. And before you tell me what it means, what made you interested in children experiencing trauma?
Yep. I think as hokey as it sounds, I really want to make the world a better place for children. Like that is mm-hmm. that is truly what I want on my tombstone. He made the world a better place for kids. And it seemed to me that helping the kids who, you know, trying to figure out a way to support the kids who struggle the most was what I wanted to dedicate my life to. And as I began working with children, I just saw that so many children were hurt, they were wounded, they were afraid, and trauma was always the way that they were presented to me. That was sort of the language that was used. And I think as I sort of got more involved in this world of supporting children who were struggling, I've watched that term begin to change. And it feels like it's become sort of another sort of coded word for at risk or urban. You know, I think in the time that I've been in education, we've had these sort of eras where we've tried to find more appropriate ways to talk about what feels like the good old-fashioned deficit perspective, maybe a race perspective, a class perspective. And it feels like trauma has now entered that territory, that mm-hmm. now it's more polite to talk about children or schools as being traumatized. But that's just a way of diagnosing systems or cultures or behaviors. And it really doesn't help us see the child, which I think fundamentally is the purpose of education, of relating, of kind of being a human in the world, to feel seen, valued, and heard.
I noticed that I think it's your first chapter, you open with a couple of cases, 3-year-old Trina, holy terror in her preschool classroom, and then it turns out she's nightly abuse that she and her mother are experiencing at home, or 10-year-old Juan who has trouble paying attention because he's worried his family's going to be deported. You have many, you know, individual cases where we can then start to understand what you're talking about. But if you had to step back from those cases and say, trauma is what? How would you define trauma as opposed to just something that's difficult? That, I mean, all children, all people go through difficult times. So when does it become trauma?
Yep. So I think I'll answer it in sort of two different ways. One, I think physiologically. So our body has a hardwired stress response system that when it is triggered, we are no longer in control of our actions. We fight, we flee, or we freeze. And so I think one clear definition of trauma is when that stress response system is triggered and suddenly we are sort of reacting, not behaving. So I think that is one way to define trauma. And I think sort of psychologically, that stress response system becomes triggered when an external event, so something outside of us, happens that causes us to feel overwhelmed or that that we do not have the capacity to cope with. And usually that means that we feel helpless or hopeless, and it fills us with terror. So when that happens, that stress response system is triggered, and then we are in the midst of a traumatic response. So that is my definition of trauma. If you're not afraid for your life, if you don't feel helpless or hopeless, and if your stress physiology system has not been triggered, then you're just really scared or you're having a really bad time. But it's not trauma in the way that I think about it. And I think in the book, I try to distinguish between trauma and adversity. And that matters from an intervention perspective, because when children are in a state of trauma, they actually aren't in control of their behaviors in the same way. They're simply responding to this thing that scares them to death. And so trying to use a behavioral intervention isn't going to work. We really have to help the child feel safe. But I think that children who do not necessarily kind of meet that definition of trauma are still navigating a lot of fear and insecurity and instability, and those things need to be tended to as well. So the book is meant to support us in responding to both adversity and trauma, but they're sort of different things. I talk about messiness.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's your first chapter title has the phrase messy lives, which, again, didn't sound very academic.
Right.
But you talk about children with messy lives. Why did you choose that phrase?
Yeah, you know, I think to sort of humanize the experience of trauma and to help us sort of to draw our attention to sort of what is actually the problem. So when we talk about trauma and behavior, which is the way that we typically talk about it in education and psychology, we're sort of looking at the child and her or his symptoms, and we're kind of locating the problem in the child. This child has trauma. This behavior reflects trauma. But trauma, by definition, is when something happens to you that fills mm-hmm. you with terror. And so it is the circumstances of the child's life that is actually the challenge. And if we aren't addressing or being responsive to or understanding to whom or to what the child is responding, we're just helping the child cope with the situation that is still terrifying. And so so the whole notion of messiness is kind of meant to draw our attention to the fact that the problem is not the child's behavior. The problem is that the child feels terrified or that the child's life is complicated. I also think that that term messy is sort of meant to help us sort of empathize with children. You know, sometimes when kids walk into the classroom or they walk into the therapy office, we think about them as students and clients, and we look at their outcomes and their achievement. But, you know, like the rest of us, if you've had a rough morning or you have something going on in your life, that's all consuming. And so I think that that the term messy is really meant to help us just recognize and hold at the front of our mind that many children navigate really complicated lives, and that if we keep imposing sort of these very simplistic notions or strategies of support, then we're probably not going to be super effective.
What role would you say poverty plays in that messiness?
Absolutely. So, you know, definitely poverty can create messy circumstances. Not all children who experience poverty become traumatized by it. Many families have very sophisticated coping skills, and so kids don't feel filled with terror. Life's just hard, right? Or they navigate a lot of complicated issues. Some kids are overwhelmed by the deprivation and despair and the stressors that are associated with poverty. And so poverty, kids who experience poverty are much more likely to experience traumatic symptoms. But certainly, poverty is a stressor. And if you're worried about what you're going to eat or where you're going to sleep, or if your parents are highly stressed, if you're, one of your parents is out of work, or there's like conflict in the family because they're limited resources, those things make it very hard to focus on learning or your studies, or to even care about your future if you're trying to survive in the present. So I think poverty is definitely sort of a – it creates a lot of complication and certainly creates a lot of messiness in many of our lives.
We're going to talk about individual children, some case studies, and what happens when they come from a background of trauma and wind up in a classroom or in a therapy suite when we return in a moment with University of the Air. I was lying in bed trying to go to sleep when I heard people screaming. I was afraid. All of a sudden, Mom ran into the room, grabbed me out of bed, and hid me in the closet. She seemed so scared and told me to be quiet. Right after, Dad ran into the room and tried to hide under my bed. Right then, the cops ran into my room, too. They grabbed Daddy and drug him out the door. I was so mad and sad and scared. That's some comments by a traumatized child. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Travis Wright, and we are talking about his book, Emotionally Responsive Teaching, Expanding Trauma-Informed Practice with Young Children. Travis, one of the things that I really liked in your book was the number of stories that you include, both from your own family, but also from different classrooms, different clients that you worked with. Pick some. You know, yep. I think the best way to understand the topic is to kind of imagine ourselves either teaching a particular child or working in therapy with a child and kind of understanding the complexity of what that child is going through.
Sure. So I think a story that sort of haunts me is one that happened when I was working in Washington, D.C. The district had made the decision to sort of fire the counselors and hire more instructional coaches. So I started volunteering as a counselor in a school. And one of the kindergarten teachers said, you know, don't worry, you won't need to see my kids. My kids just need, you know, home training, good training, so they won't need therapy. And so I was shocked the next day when the teacher sort of asked me to come to her classroom. So when I got there, I said, you know, what's going on? She goes, they told me that they wouldn't expel this kindergarten student unless you sign the form. And I said, you know, he's in kindergarten. I don't think expulsion is really the place that we should start. Why don't you tell me what's going on? I'll see if I can help. She said, I'll show you. And so the teacher sort of flicked the lights on and off, and sort of all the kids sort of ran and sat at their desks and crisscross applesauce, and they looked scared. But this one child sort of ran and cowered in the corner, and the teacher sort of walked over and stood over him and pointed her finger and said, get to your seat. And the kid stood up, cursed at her, stomped her foot, and ran across the room. And the teacher became sort of apoplectic, like she just lost it and chased the child, and the child just became filled with rage and terror and sort of ran out of the classroom. And so I sort of, you know, went and found the child, spent the day with him. Later that evening was speaking with her, with his mother, and she explained that she had sort of taught the child to respond that way if he ever felt afraid in his body. She'd sort of come to realize that she sort of had a number of registered sex offenders living within a few blocks of her home. And so she had taught the child to sort of make himself as scary and as unattractive as possible if he ever felt afraid in his body. And she said that, you know, she never thought that her child would have to feel that way at school. And this child was sort of stuck in the middle of like the demands of the classroom and the demands of his life, that, you know, the parent said that if I told him to make exceptions for teachers, probably the first thing that a predator would say is, I'm a teacher or a coach. Mm-hmm. And so in her mind, she really felt like if she was teaching the child the best way she could to protect himself, but that same way that he had learned to survive in his life outside of school was placing him at tremendous risk of sort of academic failure, social isolation inside of school. And I think that that many kids with difficult lives sort of navigate that, right? Like school is sort of typically designed around the demands of a middle class life, and schools are organized to be not messy. Mm-hmm. And so when children come to school having learned to sort of navigate very complicated circumstances, many times what they've learned to survive in the scary part of their life doesn't really work in the classroom. And when teachers sort of don't understand that or don't account for that, they typically, the way that we typically respond to children who are sort of misbehaving is we try to restrict their control. So we try to take power away from them. Trauma, by definition, is feeling powerless and out of control. So when someone tries to take power away from you, you get bigger, meaner, scarier. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes the kids that really need the safety of the classroom the most are experiencing it as sort of vying for power and control, trying to have control of them, sort of trying to sort of torment them into submission. And so this place that could actually be an island for children, a place of real comfort and peace, becomes just one other scary part of their life. And so unless we really look at sort of what children's behavior means as opposed to just what they're doing, sometimes the kids that need our love the most sort of get the most negative response from us in our classrooms.
So this child that was cowering and afraid because he had learned to be afraid of strangers and sort of on the streets at home,
yep.
I would assume would also be afraid of a therapist. You know, that let's say you have that kindergartner with just you away from that classroom. What do you do so that this child doesn't get expelled?
With many of the children with whom I work, sort of asking them to come with me alone to a playroom is actually a terrifying thing. Mm-hmm. So I often begin the work inside the classroom or do almost all the work inside the classroom as I did with this child. But on the day that it was time for him to transition to the playroom, like, he flipped out. Like, he was like, I don't know you. You're going to hurt me. And so sort of part of our work therapeutically became sort of learning how to recognize who you can trust, who you can't trust, sort of how do you sort of maintain those boundaries and keep yourself safe. We decided that, like, his mom needed to actually come and give permission rather than sort of me sort of trying to convince him. You know, based on the circumstances of his life, it made more sense for his mom to say, yeah, this person's okay. You can go with him. So that's, I think, an example of how even sort of the answer to the challenge has to be contextual. Like, you know, if I just said any nice man that sort of comes to your classroom for a while and then says come to his classroom is a safe person, that obviously could have made that child less safe. So a lot of times in schools, teachers believe that respect is sort of a prerequisite for learning. So this child can't learn until they respect me. But for many children who have been hurt by adults or by other people, respect is actually something that, you know, automatically according respect to a person that you don't know could actually make you less safe mm-hmm. in the world. And so I talk to teachers about sort of viewing respect as something to be earned and reinforced as opposed to being something that is demanded. So how can you teach children in a way that earns their respect as opposed to requiring children to respect you before you can teach them? And so I think that process of building trust and respect with this particular child took a lot of time. It took public time. It took private time. It took his mm-hmm. family sort of endorsing our relationship. But then sort of once he felt safe and once he trusted me, I think he did have an opportunity to feel what it was like to be close to someone that was safe. He had a chance to sort of imagine a kind of masculinity even that wasn't dominant or overpowering or abusive. Like, he got to be with a man who was gentle and kind and wasn't scary. And so that was sort of another layer of the therapy, right? Like, in that holding space, he got to experience maybe a different kind of being in the world that sort of didn't negate how he might choose to be in one part of his life, but it certainly gave him more options to draw from. Working with children in schools sort of solves a lot of those problems. They sort of show up, like we have transportation that helps get them there. If I can sort of support teachers in schools and kind of understanding these children differently, then the children, sort of the skills that we work on in the therapy room can sort of become reinforced by another big part of their lives. I do a ton of work with families. But sometimes, you know, like what families are navigating and what children have to do to navigate school are different. So you can't just work with families. You really have to work with teachers as well. And so I like working with children as a therapist and really as a co-teacher in schools. It's a different model than we typically use, but I've sort of watched it really change teachers' lives, children's lives, families' lives, school lives.
It sounds wonderful, but as you're talking, I'm thinking of the reality of the public school system and budgets, where more and more you've got teachers who can't even, you know, kind of afford magic markers for their classroom, or are asking parents to help with Kleenex and, you know, different things at the budget. I don't see how, in a realistic way, if you've got, let's say you have a class of 22 kids and one teacher and many children needing the kind of one-on-one work, not rushed, but very careful, intensive work to support what's happening in the classroom and what's happening at home. How do you build that in? Because I have not seen that in any school where you had enough of that sort of counseling support to handle all the different kinds of stories that are there.
Well, so I think I kind of have two answers to the question. One is, I think there may not, you know, I don't know that I can point you to a lot of schools that I personally have visited that are sort of doing this systematically, but I can point you to a lot of classrooms. And I do think there are teachers that have figured out how to balance sort of the needs of the class and the learner with the needs of the child who may be afraid. And I think this book is really meant to identify some of those best practices or some of the things that sort of help the classroom feel more healing and more responsive to kids.
And you talk about preschools, too, and fairly young children. Can you tell us about Goddess?
Yes. So Goddess was probably the first and most important teacher in my life. Goddess was the first, one of the first two students that I began working with as a counselor trainee. She was 16 months old when I first met her, and she was sort of born in prison to her mother, was incarcerated. Her mother was released from prison and then was sort of off the radar for a year. And when she showed back up, it was in a homeless shelter. Goddess was in a plastic grocery bag covered in her own feces, and the family was in real crisis. I was working in a therapeutic preschool and began working with Goddess. And for the first 6 months, she didn't laugh. She didn't talk. She sort of just sat quietly kind of staring out the window. And anytime I would get close to her, she would just scowl or growl or yell until I would step back. And, you know, my first impulse was just to rush in and sort of like rescue her. But whenever I stepped into her, it just filled her with terror. And so Goddess really taught me the importance of respecting the inherent strength of children, right? And respecting the boundaries that she had set for herself. Every time I intruded, I just violated her. But when I respected sort of her limits, then suddenly I became a safer person and she felt more comfortable inviting me in. And so through this process of being really responsive to her needs, she did begin to trust me. And sort of there's this poignant moment in the book where I was with Goddess when she laughed for the first time. And I'm probably going to choke up now because there hasn't been once in my life that I thought about the moment and didn't choke up, because sort of in my professional life, it is certainly one of the most powerful experiences and important moments in my life to really watch and to understand in a deep way how profoundly afraid and isolated and alone this child was. Like, she really felt that the world was out to get her, and to sort of be there in that moment when she could sort of let her guard down enough to just laugh, it was really beautiful, and it was hard to get there. And I think it really taught me sort of that, you know, when children have been hurt, when children have been afraid, they shouldn't let their guards down very easily, but we have to help them let their guards down because, you know, all the other things can't get in. And one of the great losses of my life is that, you know, when I graduated, my academic advisor sort of forced me to sort of end the relationship with God as a therapeutic relationship. But I still think about her all the time. And I actually, through social media, sort of found out that she just graduated from university.
That's amazing. And hopefully is laughing.
And is hopefully laughing. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I've sort of continued to sort of search for her family or sort of look for her name. And I was able to find out that, you know, when she was 12, she won an art show. She graduated from college. And, you know, I don't know if Goddess remembers me at all. I worked with her for about 4 years, probably about 20 hours a week. I don't know if she remembers me, but I will never forget her.
I would think that some of your work as a counselor would put you in that mandated reporter category where you have to report, you know, like you were mentioning the plastic bag with the feces and everything else. If you were in a position where you saw that there was sort of abuse in the home that needed to be reported, I would think that would place you in a very difficult position because you know that sometimes then the alternative is when Child Protective Services comes in would be to place that child in foster care, which can also lead to more abuse or different kinds of issues. Have you found that to be a problem throughout this journey? Is this sort of, you know, there's something wrong that needs to be reported and you're required to, but you also know that it may lead to actually an even worse outcome.
Like, so some things I've learned that are going to feed into this answer is that we have to be kind. We have to be generous. We have to be fair. We have to be just. We have to be honest. And so I think all of those things have really kind of changed the way that I intersect with kind of the mandated reporting phase. So like maybe just to get out of bed every day and do this work. Like, I really believe that people are doing the best they can, even if it isn't good enough. I've never worked with a parent in my life who hurt their children who had not also been deeply hurt. I'm very clear from the beginning and always that my job is to protect children and protect families, and I want everyone to be successful. And sometimes that means that they can't be together. I say that on the first day when I first began working with the family. But, you know, I used to, when I first started doing this work and a child would disclose, I would immediately sort of report. I would sort of protect the child. And the family sort of would view me as being kind of at odds with them. And frequently the child would be removed from the home. It would create more crisis and chaos. Sometimes children do need to be removed from the home to be safe. But it really positioned me sort of at odds with the family. And so I went from being a support to being sort of a part of the system. What I've really begun to do is to sort of call the family first and say, you know, there's this thing that the child shared and I really care about the child. And you know, I have to share it. I want to be here to support you in being successful. If, you know, if you are willing to kind of admit that you need some help and some support and you're willing to make the phone call, I'll be here to support you. And then however I can help you get through it, I'm here to be with you. And with one exception, families have always been willing to call and to say, I did this thing and I need some help. And I noticed that when I started approaching it that way, families almost never removed their child from my school. So I think I've learned that I can be really tough and really kind. And if I'm really honest, that it helps kind of cut through a lot of the secrets and the messiness. And, you know, so there's so many lies and secrets and hidden wounds and pain that people, families, kids, parents, teachers navigate. And in my experience, good things never happen in dark, hidden places. And so if we can kind of create the conditions for people to sort of share those things, I think it's more likely that there will be the possibility for healing to occur. And that's, I just want to help, you know, like I really want to help. And I think that I think that's part of what the book is about as well, is being able to tap into that sort of deep desire and commitment to help. Like, how do you continue to work with an open heart when your heart has been broken? I think is absolutely a part of this work. But I think people who've had broken hearts and learned to heal are often the ones who are best equipped to help others.
Well, because they have compassion. And you do talk near the end of your book about compassion fatigue, burnout, and so on. We'll talk about that and also about some solutions, what we can do to change the situation of not responding adequately to children experiencing trauma. More in a moment when we return with University of the Year.
Our once confident and outgoing little girl became quieter and seemingly more fragile. She had difficulty falling asleep and found it more difficult to separate from us, and we had more trouble being away from her, too. I found myself waking in the middle of the night to check on her, touching her chest to make sure she was breathing. She, too, was more likely to wake with nightmares, crawling into our bed to fall back asleep.
That's my guest, Travis Wright, reading from his book, Emotionally Responsive Teaching. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with University of the Air. You write so movingly, Travis, about your daughter Olivia's near drowning. Was she three?
She was three, yes.
Yeah. Why did you choose to include that in this book?
Yeah, I think that it is, it's one of the ways I've learned about trauma. And it's one of the ways that I've learned about sort of how vulnerable children and families can feel in the face of really scary circumstances. And it's also one of the ways that I've learned how powerful sort of these traumatic experiences can become as sources of strength and resilience as we learn to heal from them. And, you know, I realize that I'm asking sort of teachers, parents, children to be incredibly vulnerable as a part of this work. And it just seemed important for me to be able to be as vulnerable myself in sharing how I've come to this insight.
You talk about the journey throughout the book from fear to hope, that you take these times of tremendous fear and pain and loss and worry, but somehow from that find hope. What can parents do? You know, we've been talking about teachers and counselors mostly.
Yep.
But parents who are working with a child, living with a child that's gone through something traumatic, you know, has witnessed a murder, has been in a school shooting, has gone through a parental divorce, has had things happen that are really hard to bounce back from. What can parents do?
Yep. So I think the first and most important thing that parents can do is to listen. Part of healing from trauma is being able to feel some power and control in or over what happened. And the most basic way that we can do that is to find a way to sort of hold the story of what happened. And I think when children or families experience scary things, so often we want to sort of silence it or push it down or hide
move
it,
on.
Move on. Mm-hmm. And I think what that really does is it sort of makes the person become more isolated, or it says, like, we can't handle this. And I think when children can give voice to their fears, it begins to sort of empower them. And often, you know, when we experience the scary thing, like it's the biggest thing in our life, we can't stop talking about it. So you might find that kids just have to talk about it a lot and just let them. And eventually, you know, if it feels like the kid is stuck, and they can't sort of – they keep talking about it in a way that results in them feeling like helpless or weak, that's a really good time to sort of think about therapy or interventions that would help the child sort of find some more power in it. One thing that we can always sort of remind people who have been traumatized is that what they experienced was awful and tragic and scary, and they didn't deserve it, and they survived. Mm-hmm. Right. It doesn't mean that they aren't bruised, but they're not broken. And I think that, you know, we don't want to sort of negate what happened. We don't want to say, you know, you're OK. It's fine. But I think finding a way to start sort of reinforcing that idea that, you know, it was really scary, but you're still here. And what do you want to do with that? That's a really important, I think, message for survivors to start to integrate into their self-understanding, that it didn't kill me, I survived. And then the sort of work that I've been doing most recently that I've noticed that it seems to have a really powerful effect is helping children, survivors, you know, the book is written for young children, but I think the principles actually apply to sort of adults, mm-hmm. older children, is to invite the child to think about so much of trauma is an embodied experience. It's feeling afraid. So I've been doing a lot more work around sort of shifting the feeling in your body. So asking kids to sort of think about their superpower. Where does that superpower live in their body? What does it feel like in their body? And so when they are starting to feel afraid or they look panicked, sort of talking them through that experience of sort of when do you feel strong? What does it look like? What does it feel like in your body? Bring that feeling back into your body. And that is sort of a way to help children start to feel some power over how they feel, some more power over their actual bodies. And I've seen that sort of become really a powerful support in their healing.
And let's say, meanwhile, in the classroom, you've got children acting out because they're angry, they're hurt, they've witnessed abuse or have seen, you know, violence. And you have a teacher trying to teach and you've got a kid that's hitting others or throwing something or biting or whatever it is.
Yep.
You know, it's happening right now on the ground and you can't allow that to continue. Even if you know that it's coming from a place of trauma, even if you know it's a child who's not really in control, sort of in that moment, what does a teacher do? Because regardless of how much you know and care, you have to keep some kind of order and peace in the classroom.
Yep. So I would say that the support for that moment really starts well before that moment happens. When kids are in that state of response, they are fighting, fleeing, or freezing for their lives. And so it is very hard to intervene meaningfully when kids are already in that place. And so much of the work that we have to do to create an emotionally responsive classroom has to be done sort of in preparation and in prevention of those moments. So having a predictable classroom schedule, having some, you know, teachers monitoring their tone, noticing what types of things trigger kids and minimizing those triggers, sort of talking with kids after they've lost it or before they've lost it about what do you do when you're afraid. So I recommend that teachers have, like, you know, allow children to identify like a safe place in the classroom. Sometimes kids bring a stuffed animal, a favorite book, a favorite blanket. And I practice if kids, you know, are getting triggered a lot, I do sort of practice runs. When the child isn't triggered, like, what is the feeling in your body? What happens just before you lose it? When you're starting to feel that feeling, let's practice going to your safe place. Mm-hmm. So that when kids are afraid, the response is more organized. They know where to go. They know how to mm-hmm. keep themselves safe. They can put the blanket over their head.
And they identify then, this is what's happening.
This is
what I do. The teachers are aware. You also talk about how teachers and counselors bring with them certain biases that can almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy, that if you see a child as at risk and a potential failure and, you know, somebody to be afraid of, that can then translate into a way of interacting with that child that makes that happen even more.
Yes, absolutely. You know, our expectations are sort of the biggest determinants of children's outcomes in our classrooms. And in the book I write about teaching from hope versus teaching from fear, you know, I've never met a teacher in my life that didn't want kids to be successful. And I think if we talk to teachers about their expectations, then, you know, teachers just don't – nobody has bad expectations for their students. But what I've learned is that it's not really the expectations that determine the differences in the way kids are taught. It's really our hopes or our fears. So children for whom we have a lot of hope, children who we think are going to be really successful, we teach from that place of hope. So what do you want to be when you grow up? What do you think about this? Tell me your ideas. Like, what's going to make you feel important? But when we have a lot of fears for kids, we tend to sort of focus more on minimizing their risk. So sit down. I don't want you to get out of control. Be quiet. I don't want you to get in trouble. Like, remember these facts that are going to be on the test because you're going to fail, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really that hope and that fear balance that determines sort of our pedagogy and the ways that we're interacting with kids. And so I really ask teachers to sort of think about what are their hopes for the kids they teach? What are the fears for the kids they teach? Look at their actions. can your students tell you more about what you're afraid of for them, or can they tell you more about what you hope for them? And when you have difficult moments in your classroom, sort of ask yourself, was I coming from a place of fear, or was I coming from a place of hope and care? And if it's fear, think about, you know, how you might redo that moment and come from a more hopeful place. And I've seen that little intervention, that sort of, if teachers use that sort of daily as an ongoing reflection tool, it can radically change their teaching practice.
Would that be similar to the idea of simply finding children's strengths? Teach to the strengths, you know, find the gifts. Assume that everyone has potential and that there's something you can nurture, and, you know, rather than sort of looking at what's going on.
Absolutely. You know, it's, yeah, that's it. We have to, I think, hold complicated views of children, right? Like, we have to see their strengths while also being aware of their challenges. And that's one of the things about trauma and why I chose to write to teachers first, is because sometimes when we think about trauma, we think about just sort of emotions and behavior and feelings. But we're learning more and more that trauma actually has profound implications for brain development and the way kids learn. So, you know, I think primarily about young children in this book. And one of the things that is sort of a fundamental skill in sort of becoming a sort of productive learner for young children is the ability to sort of recognize cause and effect relationships and being able to make predictions and being able to use context clues. Those three things are kind of the trifecta. And if you think about growing up in a really messy environment where it's totally unpredictable, it might be chaotic. One day you get a consequence, the next day you get a lollipop. Kids don't necessarily develop an internal sense of order or logic. Like, you know, maybe you've been good today and you get smacked. Maybe you were really bad and then you get chicken. Like, kids don't see necessarily these cause and effect relationships. And when kids don't have those sort of internalized sort of ways of thinking about things, a lot of the teaching that we're doing in the classroom that sort of rests on the assumption that kids have those skills just don't stick. Like, it just goes right, you know, it just, the kids don't have a schema for it to hang on to. And so one of the things that I sort of talk to teachers a lot about is that, you know, I'm not just asking you to teach while thinking like a counselor. Teachers are critically important in helping kids heal from trauma. And, like, there are things that only teachers kind of do in society to help kids learn, that unless they are able to do those things, even if kids become sort of more emotionally responsive, they're not going to be able to learn. And nothing is as empowering or as important in helping us feel hopeful about our future as feeling smart and like we can be successful.
And feeling loved and cared for. And I like the fact that you end your book kind of telling teachers and counselors, take care of yourself too. This is hard work. Thank you so much. My guest has been Travis Wright. His book is about emotionally responsive teaching. And I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Love, but I reject it. Trade my joy for my protection. Grab my hand, I'm drowning. I feel my heart pounding. Why haven't you found me yet? I hold you so proudly. Traumas, they surround me. I wish you just loved me back.